Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the February 12th meeting of the Portland City Council. Would you please call the roll?
Fritz.
Here.
Fish.
Here.
Saltzman.
Here.
Novick.
Here.
Hales.
Here. Welcome, everyone. We have a single item on the agenda this afternoon, so we know why you're here, and welcome. We're continuing, and I'll get Carla to read the item in a moment, continuing our discussion of these changes to our code regarding demolition. We will get the item read, and then we'll take staff presentation and testimony. For those of you who have spoken here before, you know the rules, but for those who haven't, you don't need to give us your address, just give us your name. If you're a lobbyist representing an organization, you do need to please disclose that under our city code's requirements. With a long agenda like this, or a lot of people signed up, we typically ask you to hold your comments to 2 minutes, so please try to be succinct. If somebody else has said what you want to say, you feel free to give them a thumbs up or wave your hands, and if you want to, wave your moment to speak, but you don't have to. The point of that reminder is we like to let everybody have their say, so please don't make any vocal demonstrations in favor or against your fellow citizens' point of views, and I think they'll do the same for you. So welcome, and Carla, would you please read the item?
Item 169, amend building demolition code to require notice and delay for all single-family residential demolitions in areas with a residential comprehensive map designation, and make other changes.
Mr. Fritz.
Thank you, Mayor, and thanks to everybody who's been engaged in this process, both volunteers and staff. It's been a very constructive set of discussions, and I'm happy to be here today with a substitute ordinance. So I'm going to invite Nancy Thorington from the Bureau of Development Services to come up and explain what the substitute is. I think I'll move the substitute first so that we just have it on the table.
Okay. There's a motion to put the substitute before us.
And second.
Further discussion? Then a roll call to put the substitute on the table for us to discuss.
Fritz.
So Nancy's going to go through and explain what all the changes are since the December version, and that then will form the basis of what we'll be asking everyone to comment on. Aye.
Fish.
Aye.
Saltzman.
Aye.
Novick.
Aye.
Hales.
Aye.
Okay. Thank you, council members. I have a PowerPoint here that should be coming up in a second to help us go through this, because it's been nearly 2 months and a lot of information here. So this first slide is basically, this is an overview. I'm going to just go over what was presented originally, our proposed changes, and then some of the cost issues. So in December, we came before you with an amendment, a proposed amendment that would add mailed notice to the properties within 150 feet and door hangers to the notice of the demolition. It would make all the residential structures subject to the initial 35-day delay, and change the current 120-day extension and replace it with a 30-day extension, and then remove the current exception to that notice and delay provision. The other amendments were to add definitions to the code. Right now, there is no definition of demolition either in state law or in our ordinance, so we wanted to add those in there. And we also added a category for major alterations and additions, because there was a lot of input from the community about what essentially are called these virtual demolitions. So that provision addresses those. And we are not proposing any changes to that one. This slide here gives you at least an idea of the numbers that we're looking at for the residential permits for 2013 and 2014. The total permits in 13 were 281. The total for last year were 312. We're on course to process about 370 this year. So the next column shows the number that are exempt under the current code. You'll see the difference in 2013, it was 212, and last year it was 177. And the reason for that number going down was about mid-year, our director, Scarlett, changed the interpretation so that fewer of the permits were covered by the exception. And so you can see the number then reflected in that were subject to the notice. And of those, the number where there was 120-day delay requested In 2013, it was 2, and in 2014, it was 5. Those aren't huge numbers, but you can see the trend upward in terms of the number of the exceptions or the delay exceptions, I'm sorry, extensions that are being requested. So in response to the hearing on the 17th, we went back to address the demolition delay extension because that was really the issue that the public was concerned with. So we met with the Development Review Advisory Committee, Subcommittee, the full DRAC, the United Neighbors, Neighborhoods for Reform, Restore Oregon, the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, and our code hearings officer to address this issue of the demolition delay extension. And we reached consensus among these stakeholders for the proposal that's before you now. This next series of slides is, I put it in these three columns to help give you an idea of the first column is the existing code, what's in there now, what we presented on the 17th, and what we're proposing now. This first one is the notice provision. So right now, if you come into BDS and you ask for a demolition permit, you get this huge orange poster that gets posted on the site. And we are proposing removing that requirement based on input that those basically attract criminal activity and don't really give the notice that is very effective. So in lieu of that, we are recommending having the properties within 150 feet get mailed notice and also to the recognized organizations. That isn't changing. We are just adding a recommendation to include the Architectural Heritage Center and Restore Oregon to the organizations that would get notice to help, you know, get that further out into the community. The demolition delay, right now in the code, there is all demolitions are subject to a 35-day delay, except if you're going to have a one-for-one replacement. And what we have proposed is to eliminate that exception, so everything would be subject to the delay. So this is where we get into the real meat of this, the extension period. So who may request it? Right now in the code, any recognized organization whose boundaries include the site, we are recommending adding any interested party. The time of the extension. So right now it's 120 days, and all that has to happen is the recognized organization sends BDS a letter and requests the extension, and that extension is automatic. It's for 120 days, and when you add that with the 35 initial delay, that's a total 155 days. What we presented on the 17th was a 30-day mutually agreed-upon notice, and that was the issue that people were not happy with because there was not enough. It was mutual, so there was no teeth in it. There was no way to enforce it, and they said it was too short. So what we're proposing now is a 60-day delay in addition to the initial 35, which would give a total of 95 days. And that would be granted, or what would be required for that would be that the appellant submit an application for an appeal to BDS for a hearing for the codes hearings officer, along with a fee or a fee waiver and supporting documentation showing that they're actively pursuing an alternative to demolition. So again, who can appeal under the current code? It's the applicant for the demolition permit is the appellant now. And what we're proposing is to switch that so that whoever is asking for the extension is the one who has to request the appeal. And right now the burden, therefore, because the applicant is the one who is filing the appeal, they have to show that the recognized organization that requested the extension is not making a good faith effort to work on an alternative to demolition. And they have to pay the appeal fee, which at this point is $1,300. What we're proposing now is to shift the burden so that the appealing party shows that they're actively pursuing an alternative to demolition. And what we've got here are four criteria. The first one is showing notice that you've tried to contact the owner. And this we're doing via certified mail, although we certainly will encourage people to talk directly to the property owner, but at least with the certified mail, we know we have an objective criteria to know that they've actually reached out and tried to contact the property owner. The second one, this one is the property has some significance to the neighborhood, as demonstrated by architectural significance, the age and condition of the house, or some other factor. This is in response to some feedback, basically, that the council, you know, gave at the September 17th hearing that, you know, obviously not all old buildings are worth saving, and, you know, so there should be something that shows why this particular structure is important. In addition, a plan to save the structure. So not just saying, okay, we like this building, but what are you going to do? Show us something concrete that shows that you can do this. And then the last one, I really appreciate the input of the United Neighbors for Reform, because they helped us craft this one. Actually, they crafted it. Which is great, because it gives some nice objective criteria for the hearings officer to apply, which includes providing a pro forma budget and evidence of either funds on hand or a plan, a fundraising plan sufficient to meet that. So that creates basically what the code hearings officer would use to determine whether they're actively pursuing the alternative to demolition. This slide shows what happens as a result of the appeal. So if the burden isn't met, then right now under the ordinance, if it is met, I'm sorry, then the BDS can issue the permit. And under the proposed revisions, if the applicant for the appeal meets the criteria, then they get an additional 60 days in addition to the initial 35 days. So that's a 95-day window. If they don't meet that burden, then BDS can issue the permit any time after receiving notice of the decision. So what we were trying to do was create a finite universe so that it can never go past the 95 days. So this third bullet basically explains that. So let's say somebody comes in on the 35th day and they file their application for an appeal. And then if the code hearings officer doesn't get to the hearing for another 30 days and then their decision doesn't happen within that 30 days after that, you've got your 95 days have expired. If that happens, then BDS can issue the permit regardless of whether the hearings officer has rendered a decision, because it's a 95-day maximum cutoff. So that gives the balance, we think, between the finality for the property owner and 95-day window when the issuance of the permit is stayed. And then this just shows, again, that the exception to the notice and delay, we are recommending removing that. One of the other issues that's been raised in conjunction with this is the deconstruction issue, and it came up a little bit at the last hearing, and we've talked with BPS and DRAC and UNR. Deconstruction is kind of just a slow and green version of demolition, so we wanted to make sure that we address this properly, and we think that BPS thinks that they're the better organization to be taking the lead on this, with input from DRAC. One of the issues is the code that's before you is basically regulatory, what you can do, what you can't do when you're engaging in a residential demolition. And deconstruction's different because it's an incentive program. It's, you know, what are we going to give you for doing deconstruction instead of demolition? And so it really is different considerations that I don't think belong in a code, and the stakeholders pretty much agreed that it was better to put that off and discuss it with the right stakeholders and all of the right stakeholders, because we were focused on the demolition pieces that we had, and so the deconstruction, we didn't have any deconstruction experts, and we didn't fully vet it, so... This last one here is just the major alteration and demolition comparison. I'll just briefly, on the major alterations, all we're doing for that is seeking, it gives a 35-day delay from the time that somebody posts notice. They have to put door hangers on the surrounding properties and email the recognized organizations. And the purpose of that is to make sure that the surrounding property owners know if there's one of these big alterations where they're taking down half the house or they're adding a story or something like that. So that's just a recap. These last two slides are on the fee. So the appeal fee is $1,300, and it's a fee that's charged by the code hearings office. So it's not a fee that we can waive, and they won't waive it. They don't have any way of doing that, nor will they. So basically, it's something that if we want to waive the fee, we have to come up with the money from somewhere because we can't use our permit fees. State law restricts how we can use our permit fees to things related specifically to the implementation of the permit and inspection program. So on this last slide here, this shows the total cost. The first part of this is the notice. And we project about 370 permits for the demolitions and about 3,500 for the major alterations. And so that just shows the mailing costs and the staff time at about 46,000. Then related to processing the appeals and any of the other associated tasks with this, we anticipate it might take up to a full-time employee at 80,000, and then we're kind of shooting in the dark here on the appeal fee waivers. We have no idea how many are going to come in, so we just made a projection at 20%, and that's what that 97,000 is based on. So, with that, I will take any questions.
To be clear, we're not requesting that right now. The Development Review Advisory Committee subcommittee is going to continue working on the issue of what fees could be added to the permit fee and what cannot. And then we'll be rolling that, having a late add into the budget or perhaps into a bump so that council will have that decision to be made separately. We just wanted to highlight for everybody that there are costs involved and not all of them can legally be assigned to the person applying for the demolition. So there will need to be some general fund allocation.
And the waiver policy that we have for neighborhood associations applies on the appeal side here as well.
It does. Yeah. It's very similar to the land use review process. However, with land use reviews, it is legal to tack that additional cost onto the upfront permit fee, application fee. Mm-hmm. It's not for this process.
Right.
So we wanted to mirror it so that no neighborhood association is prohibited from appealing because of the cost. On the other hand, we don't have a readily available bucket to get that from, and so we wanted to flag that for you, Mayor.
Yeah, good.
Thank you.
I have a question.
Yes.
And it has to do with the requirement that the on the burdens, when you listed the burdens that someone has to meet to get the extension of delay, you have in there a certified letter, a copy of a certified letter to the developer.
The property owner.
Yeah.
That's a pretty high bar.
Send a letter certified mail return receipt requested?
Well, I'm just saying it's a high bar generally because, like, as a recovering lawyer, you can send a letter as a lawyer and just attest that you sent it, and there's very few requirements in the law that require certified. But I had a different question. Let's say you're up against the deadline and someone comes in, mm-hmm. and they've given actual notice, but they don't bring you a certified letter. On that technicality, could they be denied the relief they seek?
The way this code is written, yes, because what we're trying to do is keep BDS staff from having to make that determination as to whether what you've done is sufficient. So in my experience in code writing, it's pretty common to have a certified letter requirement. We have it in the zoning code as well. It just is, all you have to do is show that piece of
receipt,
you know, that's stamped by the post office that you sent it certified. It doesn't have to have come back.
I understand. That's why I'm thinking, I'm just imagining someone coming on the last day you can do this and it's a national holiday. Or there's some other reason. Are we giving you the discretion to to waive that requirement if you know if someone presents evidence that they've actually contacted the landlord.
But how would they do that, Commissioner? I mean, I understand the concern about the burden that you raised, but if we need proof that the property owner has been told, how would you get that but for the certified mail
mechanism? Well, you have you actually have no proof that the certified mail has been received.
Well, that's fair. Well, return receipt requested, though.
But you're not presenting
that. That is true. And like I say, we're encouraging people to at least, you know, to in addition, you know, make actual contact. But in talking with staff, there was just really no way to write it into code that, you know, all of the different possible permutations. I mean, you know, there might be something in an implementation in an administrative rule that said if you had something signed by the property owner saying, you know, yeah, we've been in discussions.
Okay. I know I understand why you'd want a certified letter, but
sure.
I'm just thinking of the hardship case of someone who otherwise complies with the spirit of the rule, but because of a national holiday or something or some life event can't get to the post office. I mean, it's not... I can't get to the post office with my day job, so it's just sometimes in hearings all day. So I'm just wondered if there is that exception.
Fortunately, but most people have normal jobs, like ours.
So. Well, right. Hopefully they wouldn't wait till the last day either.
About,
so
through the regs at some later date.
All right. Other questions or issues to flag, and I'm sure we'll have more later on, but
thank you.
We have some folks signed up. Now, I believe we first have some people who signed up to testify at the last hearing but didn't get the chance, so we should call that roll first, and hopefully those many, if not all those people are here, and then we'll move to people that have signed up to testify on the amendments today.
The first three of the previous testifiers I have are Scott Yelton, Shane Endicott, and Cliff Goldman.
Come on up.
And then I have them followed by Tamara DeRitter, Justin Wood, and Jess Larson.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Go ahead.
We go time?
You go ahead.
All right. Well, first of all, thank you for this opportunity. As you know, I just missed the deadline last time, and I was really afraid I wouldn't be invited back.
Thanks for your consideration about that. Put your name in the record, though.
My name is Scott Yelton. I'm here wearing a lot of hats, but one of them is I work for a company called Lovett Deconstruction. We are a deconstruction company. We basically do that demolition by hand. So we are tearing down structures using our hands and hand tools. A lot of what we do is salvaging materials, and what we are doing is releasing that burden on the environment. Did you know that one-third, this blows my mind, of all landfill material is from residential home demolition debris? We cut into that. We salvage materials that can be reused in the rebuilding process. 2x4s, 2x6s, the structural lumber that can never be replaced, unless we, of course, clear-cut old-growth forests. But if we do that, I'm going to come back and testify again that we shouldn't. So it's a solid service we're doing to the environment alone, and it's a material that's in demand. I think one of the unheralded benefits of demolition is that it takes time, and that's, I can hear the eyes roll behind me because those developers want time now. There's not enough time in the day. But we have the time to run safety protocols. We have the time to identify and dispose of toxic materials such as lead and asbestos. This is completely opposite of what you get with a backhoe and a guy who can raise a cloud of dust in one day. But I think most importantly is we have the time to actually touch base with the community. Time and time and time again, I've seen it on the project site where the community neighbors come up to us, typically not on the first day. It takes them a moment to sort of realize what's going on and express their fears, express their concerns, express their anger at times with us. But we have that time because we're there day in and day out listening, also expressing our opinions and our objectives that we are salvaging this material, that we can reuse this material. So I think there's a bridge there that we're making that demolition does not do. A guy in a backhoe does not do. So I know we are given a wink and a nod that we'll kick deconstruction down the road, but I hope the spotlight doesn't fade and that we can stand up and make a mandate for deconstruction. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Welcome. You ready with your PowerPoint?
I am. Okay. Thanks. My name is Shane Endicott, and I'm the executive director of our United Villages and the Rebuilding Center in Portland. We're a 501c3 nonprofit started by all volunteers here in Portland. It took 2 years, and we launched the Rebuilding Center in 1998, and we still have a lot of volunteers. But we also have paid staff in 6 departments. A few things I want to point out is that I'm really excited to share information about deconstruction, because when we started this, there was no all-year-round deconstruction program in the United States. And today, they're popping up all over the country. And also, it's that deconstruction is very aligned with the city's political goals, even on the website and all the visioning and other projects that have been going on. I'm going to share a video here. So I think, it is up. And I don't know if we could do the lights, but this is a demolition. And I just want to show the comparison, and I'll share some information as it's running. So as you can see, it happens very fast. But what's tied up in there is a lot of old growth. And actually, if that stuff was still in the forest, it would be protected. And it's worth a lot more than anything you can buy today. In fact, you can't get the material that's tied up in there today. And if you notice, you'll see one gentleman jump out of there. Now, the next video you're going to see is deconstruction. And we create 6 to 8 jobs for every 1 job in demolition. 6 to 8 using deconstruction for every 1. Livable wage jobs. Also, it supports small businesses all over the city. A lot of people buy the materials to feed their businesses. If you've been in any of some of the big stores and little any business district in Portland, you'll find used materials incorporated. It's beyond in style, it's an ethos. And we're just barely tapping the opportunity that sits there economically with jobs, as well as savings to our community. So since the Rebuilding Center was open, we have raised over $25 million, but it's equated to $75 million of savings to our community. And we're just scratching the surface. We're barely touching it. So there's literally millions of economic dollars to be reinvested back in our city. And I can add up easily around 1,000 jobs of how it all feeds. And we have people coming from all over the country. Am I over?
Yes, you do need to
finish. It was 3 minutes last time. I apologize.
That's fine. No, very well done. And appreciate the videos. Those are pretty amazing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, you're next. Oh, you also have graphics. Okay.
I got a picture.
All right.
It's worth 1,000 words.
Often.
Mayor Hale, City Commissioners, my name is Cliff Goldman. I live in Northeast Portland. I want to thank you for this opportunity to make my comments to you as a resident of the Beaumont-Wilshire neighborhood, ground zero for demolitions and building of tall, skinny houses. Mayor Hales, the Oregonian on January 31st had this article in the newspaper about you're going to be running in 2016. I'm very encouraged by the speech that you made at the City Club and the policy prospects. I think they're great. I hope I can support you then, especially like the policy prospect of demolitions. Hales wants to create rules on neighborhood infill to make, quote, demolition a less attractive option. Now, Oregon's population is growing, more people, and people have to live somewhere. I'd rather see greater urban density as opposed to ever expansion, pushing out, if you will, of houses beyond the urban growth boundary. This is Oregon. We're different here. This is Portland. I don't think it's weird, get it, to want to preserve the character of our neighborhoods. Now, developers want to make money. Construction workers, contractors want to work. I understand that. Houses don't last forever. The construction of new housing is inevitable. The rebuilding or refurbishing of what is natural, but it must be done right. We shouldn't build a new home without an eye to architectural compatibility, I believe. A picture is worth 1,000 words, and you can see that the tall, skinny house there is out of place. this home on Skidmore, Northeast Skidmore, does not fit. There's something wrong with this picture. Not just the aesthetic insult to the eye, but blocking of solar access, eclipsing the sun, affordability in the sense of marring of the neighborhood. I had 3 minutes last time. Let's go ahead and rebuild where we have to, but to do in a way that enhances the neighborhood's cohesiveness, is pleasing rather than shocking to the eye. We in the Beaumont-Wilshire neighborhood care about what the neighborhood looks like. The developers do not. Can't we rebuild, have new homes that are included rather than simply being imposed upon us? Please do what's in your power to do zoning changes, height limitations in accordance with the surrounding homes to make the city that you rule to be worthy of the hard work that you do in making our city livable for all, not just profitable, the blind profitability for some. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming. Thank you.
The next three are Tamara DeRitter, Justin Wood, and Jess Larson. And they'll be followed by Karen Carlson, Becky Luning, and Tanya March.
Tamara, I think you're on first.
Okay. I'm Tamara DeRitter. I'm the chairman for Rose City Park Neighborhood Association, and I'm here to speak on their behalf. The Rose City Park really supported the UNR resolution in intent, and not some of the specifics, but the intent. And I want to encourage all of you to support the mayor in the creation of an infill task force. And with that, look beyond just cosmetics of the house, but also at dealing with the massing and the rhythm, because there's other things such as creating three homes on a corner lot, which causes a mass much bigger than what is typical. And there's also split lots. And so add that to your list, if you would. Also, deconstruction, as mentioned, is to be looked at and should be looked at. It's an important part of our heritage. And I also wanted to make sure that you didn't miss updating the Historic Landmarks Commission inventory. Right now, nothing east of 82nd is on that inventory, and that's because we didn't annex it until later. So please don't miss that. One thing about the ordinance change, I'd like you to take a look at Section J. In that, it makes no sense that it adds 60 days from the day BDS received the complete demolition permit. It should be after the 35-day notice. If you're adding 60 days, it shouldn't be prior to the 5-day notification period that the staff has. And then on top of that, there's a 35-day notice to the public. So if you'd look at Clause J for that issue.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks very much. Yes, I'm trying to look at rather the modification of J that's described in the amendments.
Yeah, in the amendment, in the middle of it, it says, 60 additional days from the date BDS received the complete demolition permit application.
All right.
And so that doesn't make sense.
Okay.
Because it reduces it down to a total of 55 days, in essence. It's
supposed to be, yes, I get it, 60 plus 35. It does say 95 days in the...
Yeah, it should be 95. Right. So it should be after the 35-day notification period.
Okay, we'll check on that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Wood.
Good afternoon, and thank you, Mr. Mayor and members of the council. My name is Justin Wood. I'm with the Home Builders Association of Metro Portland. I'm also a builder with Fish Construction. We do a lot of infill housing. I'm a local second-generation builder. I want to thank staff, BDS, DRAC, and all the staff that worked on this. I do have several thoughts and comments about design standards and compatibility, but I'll hold those for a separate hearing where they're relevant. City Council tasked the DRAC back in 2014 with solving the issue of demolition. I think DRAC has worked hard on this issue, has come back with an initial proposal. City Council asked them to go back and make some tweaks, which they have done, and they've sought out the approval from different groups such as UNR and Restore Oregon. So I think they've done what they've tasked, and so I would ask the council to support the resolution that they have in front of them. Additionally, I'd just like to add a little bit of commentary regarding the importance and need of demolition, redevelopment, and infill to our area. For one, our company, most of the houses we build are geared towards first-time home buyers. A lot of them are built to people building at or below, or buying at or below median family income. This argument lately about demolition seems to be painting the picture that every house that's been torn down has been a big house, and every house that's replaced has been $500,000 or more. I can specifically tell you, and some others will hear as well, that a lot of these houses that are being torn down are small little houses, and they're being replaced with small houses for starter families. So keep in mind that there is a spectrum. It's not just large houses, and it's not just McMansions, if people want to call it that. This has also been described as not being a density issue. Yet in 2013, the city of Portland reported 283 demolitions, resulting in 553 new units. So it is an increase of 100% of density on those lots. Lastly, much has been made that we can put all our new growth and development in this region into the centers and the corridors and the downtown areas. Yet I think it's important for neighborhood associations and residents of the city to know that as Metro and the city of Portland are working on their growth projections for the region, that the city of Portland says, as part of the 2014 urban growth report, that they can handle 15,000 new single-family homes within the city of Portland. And of that, 9,400 of those are through infill, and this is in the next 20 years. And I can tell you, as somebody who looks for land and buys land, there's not 10,000 vacant lots in the city of Portland. If we are going to meet what we're telling Metro that we're going to do based on our growth, we have to have infill and demolition to do it. If we don't want to do this, then that's a separate conversation that we need to have with Metro. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Welcome.
Hi. Good afternoon. Thank you, Mayor Hales and commissioners, for welcoming this testimony. My name is Jess Larson. I'm with the Welcome Home Coalition, and we are a group of housing advocates, affordable housing providers, and community members, educators, healthcare providers, labor folks interested and concerned about affordability in our community. And we are grateful for all the work that's gone forward to get us to today with the DRAC committee and everyone involved in this work. And we just want to put something on the table for your future consideration. And that is the idea of demolition fees as a way to mitigate lost affordability in the case of some demolitions. We have a good example of some demolition fee structures in use outside of Chicago. There are a group of cities that use an elevated fee structure to do a couple of things, to deter some demolitions from occurring when it's not in the community's best interest or it doesn't increase density, where it doesn't create new affordability. But when demolitions do go forward, in the case of these cities, a $10,000 fee is collected and contributed to an affordable housing account. And that affordable housing account then gets used to help mitigate the loss of some of that lost affordability through, again, some demolitions. It allows for first-time homeowners who aren't able to break into the market to have extra funds to purchase their first-time family home. So we are very interested in this as one tool that the city can look to as a way of addressing lost affordability, gentrification, displacement throughout our community. We know here in Portland that a lot of tools that communities are using across the country are off the table for us, for our local use to mitigate affordability. And when there are tools still on the table, we hope that we can look to using them for the best outcomes for our community. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you all.
The next three are Karen Carlson, Becky Looney, and Tanya March. And the last person who did not get to speak on the 17th will be Teresa Rayford.
And thank you all for being willing to defer until today. So. I guess you're on first, Karen, and your colleagues are waiting politely for you to be first. Go ahead.
Karen, excuse me, Karen Carlson, Mayor Hales and commissioners, I have a lot to say, so I'm going to probably roll over my 2 minutes. Demolition is about a lot of different things. It's about historic preservation and neighborhood livability, public safety, social equity, and very importantly, housing policy. The demolition code changes before you have been looked at only through the eyes of BDS and the DRAC. BDS and the DRAC do not make city housing policy, and are not responsible for historic preservation and are not leading the comp plan process. They should not be the only bodies looking at the issue of demolition. Many points of view must come together. I'm going to jump into the meat of my testimony, though. The newest proposal provides for a 35-day delay with a 60-day extension upon proof the following criteria have been met. Request a meeting with a certified mail, provide evidence of the significance of the structure, develop a plan to save the structure, and to show reasonable potential to consummate the plan within 95 days by providing a pro forma and evidence that funds are on hand or a fundraising effort is sufficient to meet the financial requirements. That's a lot. That's a big amount of work. And the hearings officer, what criteria do they use to determine if a structure is significant? What about, is a plan reasonable? Is, if the developer says, I'm not going to sell the property, then the plan's not reasonable. What is, if the pro forma is feasible? I don't know hearings officers who know a lot about analyzing pro formas. And is the fundraising plan feasible? I think that's a big question. So part of this is a lot about process and timeline. Most neighborhood associations meet monthly. To request an extension, the neighborhood association must vote in support of the plan at a public meeting with notice requirements. This must happen now within 35 days of when the notice is mailed. Based on that timeline alone, I doubt that it can happen. Even ONI recommends that neighborhood associations need 60 days to make decisions on important issues. In conclusion, I think that the present 120-day delay does have flaws, but the proposed code change is neither a compromise nor a real alternative. Effectively, it trades 120-day delay for 35 days. The 60-day extension is very unlikely to ever happen. So let's be honest about it. Let's either keep the 120-day delay until a real proposal is developed or eliminate it altogether. Please don't prevent. It's an acceptable solution. I do want to add two more parts. I do think we need an automatic 120-day extension for anything that's on the historic resource inventory, and that you cannot remove something from the historic resource inventory for 120 days. Right now, you can remove it in one day, and there's no demolition delay required. Secondly, all of this is placing the burden on the neighborhood association. There is already precedent in code that many developments require neighborhood contact by the developer. It's in 33700025. You can look it up yourself. If we could place the first step burden of notice on the developer to notify the neighborhood association that they're planning a demolition and then require them to come in with that proof, then the neighborhood association has a chance to maybe in that next 35 days pull together a plan. Otherwise, it'll never happen.
Thank you. I got to check. Are we sure that all the criteria that you just mentioned are still in the code?
Yeah,
we didn't take any of that out of the amendments.
Right.
So those specifications for what you have to do to get the 60-day extension are all still as
right.
Okay, as they were. Okay.
Well, they're revised since.
But they're all still there. The requirements she just iterated are all still there in the draft.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Becky Looning. I'm the chair of the Woodstock Neighborhood Association, but I'm not here in that official capacity today. Although I do want to mention that we were the 40th to sign on to the UNR resolution, and our name was not read at that December 17th hearing, so you can add us to that list. I want to urge you to take swift, strong action to slow the rate of demolition and redevelopment in my neighborhood. At minimum, I hope you will fulfill the request to create a task force, and I would recommend Eastmoreland neighbor Rod Merrick as a good candidate for that task force. If and when the task force is formed, it would be great to include a representative from Woodstock as well. We are one of the hardest hit neighborhoods in the city with regard to demolition and McMansion developments. I understand the need for infill, for creating more density in the neighborhoods. I'm bothered by the things that are being displaced in the process, including light and privacy and garden areas where children can play and water can be filtered, not to mention many high-value mature trees. So I can let some of those things go. There are some nice developments that happen when people split off their side yards or their backyards. The most disturbing trend in our neighborhood is we're seeing a lot of sound, affordable homes being demolished in order to split the lots and erect two very large homes where there was once one. Now, as we speak, one block south of where I live on Southeast Steele, both east and west of 60th, there are three different developments underway, bringing six new very large homes in. All this activity causes feelings of instability among neighbors. It makes us realize that every single property in our neighborhood is vulnerable to redevelopment. It raises people's fears about being priced out of their own neighborhood. Homes that are going would sold for an average of $250,000 are being replaced with new homes that are selling more like $470,000. This is not what I would call infill. This is what I would call redevelopment. And wholesale redevelopment of our established neighborhoods does not fit with the city's stated values of diversity, equity, and especially non-sustainability, because these homes take, 50 years for the ecological, whatever cost to be absorbed by the environment. So I urge you to create the task force that can look at these issues. I've heard that other cities, maybe Seattle, maybe Austin, Texas, have found ways to address this big box development trend, because it's something that people feel in their gut that something's out of whack here, you know, that the lack of consideration of context and scale of the existing neighborhood. In Portland, when we were shopping for a home, my husband's a double amputee, and access can be difficult when there's a lot of stairs. And there's a dearth of one-story homes in Portland, especially close in. Woodstock is like the new close in. I think that's why what's driving this trend. You know, the market forces, obviously. The very few homes, you know, nice ranch homes that were built by owners in 1950s, are now being torn down only because they are on, you know, lots that are seen as double lots. One thing that could be done to address the trend is to go back to respecting the R5 zone, as meaning, you know, 5,000 square feet instead of 3,500 square feet. Another thing would be to increase setbacks or tie setbacks to heights to try to make homes just be a little more modest, or at least not to have such an impact on the house that's right next door, 5 feet away. There's do away with some of the variances that are so routinely granted through BDS permitting processes. Officially recognize the historic 25-by-100 plats as building blocks, not buildable lots. There's a lot of small tweaks that could be made, and I know that a lot of people in Portland are studying this and could figure out some fixes pretty quickly. And still, there would be plenty of opportunity for development. So thank you.
Well, Becky, thanks to the Woodstock Neighborhood Association for bringing the appeal to council late last year regarding a lot that was comprehensive plan designated R2.5, but it was in the R5 zone, and the council denied that application. And following up from that, I've sent a memo to the Land Use Services in Development Services to clarify what's now the council's interpretation of our code. Because let's be clear that there are some lots where a demolition is allowed pretty much by right.
I understand.
And then there are other lots where it also requires a partition or a land division or, as you say, some kind of a variance or adjustment. And so I've given direction to the Bureau of holding applications to a higher standard, and that does include some assessments of context, particularly on those 25-by-100 lots or where request is for less than the standard in the R2.5 zone, which is 36 feet. So I'm going to be posting that on my website probably tonight, and so I just wanted to let you know that there are other things that we can do right now. What the mayor is talking about is leading that task force through the Bureau Planning and Sustainability to make sure that everybody and all stakeholders, the development community as well as the neighborhood communities, have input into what do we want to have happen moving forward. So thank you to Woodstock for your leadership on that.
May I respond a little bit? I just wanted to mention, because you mentioned that property at 3936 Reedway, you know, that was a zoning change to 2.5, and it will be split into three lots. I'm assuming that those developments will happen in a different configuration. And the neighbors who live over there, you know, wish that they could stop it or change it somehow. And this is the most challenging thing about addressing this issue, is that every neighborhood is different. And when you talk about character of neighborhoods, it's very difficult to define. You know, that particular section of our neighborhood is the most historic, and I would argue the most needful of preservation. And yet, because it's one block off of Southeast 39th, and the city came up with this idea that homes that are close to transit corridors, or lots rather, should be have a designated zoning of 2.5 in order to increase density along those corridors, that puts that part of our neighborhood, the most historic part of it, into makes it more vulnerable. So it would be nice if there were tools that neighborhoods had to work with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability to, I mean, it's, I know it's a lot of work. We're talking about staff time and volunteer time. But to be able to say, you know, in this section of our neighborhood, we think this should be, you know, have these certain guidelines applied. And, you know, right now you're talking about the whole Southeast and Northeast having one kind of comp plan.
Oh, not necessarily.
Well, yeah, but anyway, I could go on and on, obviously.
So we'll give you that chance.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Tanya March, and I'm confused and concerned about some of the definitions. One of my confusion points on the burden section was condition of structure. That seemed very vague to me. I mean, I think of demolition by neglect as an issue for me. If somebody has allowed a property to deteriorate, how does that then allow them to meet that burden test? And in some cities, if it's going to cost more than 50% of the market value of the property in to do restoration, and that's the burden. This condition of structure was so amoebous. It didn't really have a definition. I was concerned that it would be left like that. Another concern I had was this burden of $1,318. On one hand, it sounds like us, the taxpayers, are going to end up paying this no matter what, and that concerns me. Maybe $50 or something. It's like a prescription. They charge you $5 because if you get it for free, it doesn't have value. I mean, you should at least come up with $50. I'm just something very small, but just something reasonable, sort of like that certified letter. I get nervous when I hear free. And maybe I'm only speaking for myself because I know that may not be the most popular thing. But I also, with only the neighborhoods being able to get this exemption, I'm really concerned in that 35-day turnaround. Wouldn't it be wonderful if some of our nonprofits also had that same ability? And I saw those videos with those clouds of dust that could be asbestos and lead, and I'm not a big proponent of deconstructing buildings, but I am a very big, I'm in favor of taking in place asbestos and sealing in place. And I'm really concerned that demolition is having a health impact on our communities.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much.
And the last two who signed up on the 17th are Teresa Rayford and John Wood.
Good afternoon. Oh, Teresa, I think you're on first.
All right. My name is Teresa Rayford, for the record, and there's a lot of smart people here that are in development and planning. We have my friends that have PhDs that understand a whole lot more about gentrification than I do. And I know that we're here about demolitions, but to me, it equals into demolitions and gentrification. I first heard the word from my friend Kathy Galbraith, who's with the Architectural Heritage Center, a couple of years ago when I had a name tag on my shirt that said Rayford, and she referenced the building that's owned by my family, that she thought that maybe I had the power to stop from being demolished like a lot of other buildings in our community. And with that charge, I'm looking at her like, what do you mean? The neighborhood looks beautiful. It's developed. It's gorgeous. You know, I had been living in Texas for about 15 years. So to me, it looked beautiful in the old neighborhood that I grew up in. But what she was telling me was that by these buildings being demolished and not preserved, that the character of the neighborhood was changing and that people wouldn't recognize it. And immediately, my lens changed when I went up and down the streets of Mississippi, Vancouver, Fremont, Martin Luther King, and other areas in my community. And when that vision changed, when that lens changed, my listening also changed. The words that were being told to me by different people from my community about being, that's not our neighborhood, or we don't belong there, or people don't want us there, or they took that from us. All of those different conversations changed my lens. So I wanted to learn more about demolitions, preservation, gentrification. And what I found out is that there are a lot of people in our communities across the country that are left out of these conversations about community and economic planning, and that because they're being left out of these conversations, they're feeling like their rights have been violated because their memories are being taken away along with the neighborhoods that they've grown up in, just like mine. And so with everyone asking about this 120-day delay and possibly 155, I'm thinking that what it does is it gives us an opportunity for organizations to create foundations in communities like mine so that people like myself that aren't familiar with these terms have someone to go to so that they can figure out what power they have in maintaining something that is valuable to them. So thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My name is John Wood, and I'm in the Stop Demolishing Portland Facebook group, but I don't necessarily represent them. I think the first thing I wanted to say was that while I think densification is a good thing for a variety of urban services, in some ways I think it's been oversold as the way to save down valley land. And just for example, New York City is one of the densest cities in America. And it is the densest. And it's a sprawling city. And there are other examples like that. Two, I'm concerned about who can appeal or lengthen the period of time. If it's just left down to neighborhood associations, I've served in Northwest Portland one. I've gone to, I was involved in Burnside when it existed, and then gone to Lair Hill. And they're a good model, but ultimately, if you're going to get them to act, it's the board of the whole neighborhood, that section of town. And that doesn't necessarily reflect either one neighborhood within it, and even one neighborhood within it may not reflect everyone who's there, not through meanness, but just so in Northwest Portland, I was on the board. Most of the time, there was no one who lived in the apartment blocks, and a lot of people in Wyoming Heights. Fortunately, they were kind and considerate, but that's a lot of weight to put on the goodwill of certain people. In Lair Hill, Nito Drive is good for people further southwest, but if you talk to the people who live in Lair Hill, they would just as soon lose it. 40 years ago, my mom got divorced. She didn't have any credit. She'd worked in bookstores for 30 years, and she wanted to buy a house. And she managed to find a way to buy on contract, and it was our family's get-together for 5 years fixing up this house. She had a chance at a home ownership property. This is by John's Landing, Fulton neighborhood. On the next street, there are plenty of people doing exactly the same thing. And I remember we were taking a break from fixing the house. This was probably in 76 or 77, and we just heard that parts of the Fulton John's Landing area was being upzoned. So even as we were trying to save these houses and that we got 40 years of life out of them, they were being put, potentially to be demolished. So thank you.
Thank you.
Just
thank
to clarify, any interested person can ask for the extension. It doesn't have to be only the neighborhood association.
Right. That's changed. Yeah.
Okay, that was the change. Excuse me. Thank you.
In response to testimony. Thank you.
Yeah. So thank you all. Before we switch to the next phase of this where we have people signed up today about the amendments, let me just follow up on a couple of these points because there have been some great points raised in these discussions here among the council and in the hearings. And I do intend to ask the Planning Bureau, and I know Commissioner Fritz intends to ask the Bureau of Development Services to do some additional work based on what we've heard. And one is for us to develop a concept for a deconstruction program. It is an incentive idea rather than attached directly to these requirements that apply to demolition. So we're going to ask the Planning Bureau staff to develop a proposal for a deconstruction program. We're not quite sure how that's going to work yet, but again, we're going to have them develop a concept with citizen input for how we can make that a more attractive option, because although obviously, as we've heard, the practice is increasing, there are costs and time involved. So we want to try to make that an attractive option, and we're going to have the Planning Bureau staff working with others to try to take the lead in that. Secondly, the subject of hazardous material has come up, and I think we should ask